This is KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Robert Gates, who is the new nominee for Defense Secretary after Donald Rumsfeld quit, actually, or was asked to quit or resigned last week. So on the phone, we'll be interviewing a national security analyst who has followed Robert Gates' career and will be able to give us some background on his career. Welcome. Hello.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can you hear pretty well?
Yes, this is better.
Okay, good. With us is John Prados. How would you pronounce your last name?
Prados.
Who has written books, many books on national security, including a recent one called Safe for Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA. What do you think he's a good choice for defense secretary?
Well, that has to depend on what kind of activity you want from your defense secretary. I would say that for this administration at this time, where it is reaching for some kind of support or accommodation from an American public that's very antipathetic to its whole activity, it's probably a smart choice to pick someone like Gates. He's perceived as more moderate than Rumsfeld, whom they have in right now, and he's a throwback to the first Bush administration, which is perceived by Republicans to be more even-handed than the current one. So from their particular political perspective, I think probably it looks like a good choice.
How about his background? Is that worrisome to you?
I have questions about Mr. Gates' background. I believe that he really doesn't have the experience to be the Secretary of Defense. His entire career, except for his early service as a young officer in the Air Force for 3 years in the late 1960s and early 70s when he was a staff officer and analyst, his entire career was spent at the Central Intelligence Agency and on the analytical side of the agency, except for the very last period of it when he was the deputy director for Central Intelligence and then the director of Central Intelligence. So through all of that period, he had only indirect contact with the U.S. military and was never involved in conducting any sort of a military operation. In the first Bush administration, when he served as the Deputy National Security Advisor, obviously that Bush administration conducted the Gulf War of 1990 and 1991, so there was a certain familiarity with the Pentagon and the military that followed as a result of that, but that kind of policy coordination role that the National Security Council exercises is very different from actually managing the line activities of an organization that's as ramified and as large as the Pentagon.
How about when he was deputy director of the CIA and the Iran-Contra events happened? Was he involved in directing those or supervising those activities?
That's a good question. His role in the Iran-Contra affair was, and to some degree remains, controversial. He was investigated by the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, that was set up to look at the Iran-Contra affair, and Walsh couldn't find sufficient evidence to charge Gates with positive infractions of the law, but he pretty much did find that, at a minimum, Gates looked the other way when a whole series of very illegal and very questionable activities were carried on through the CIA and to some degree using the Pentagon as well.
Yeah, so he knew what Oliver North was doing.
It's not clear. He did not know what Oliver North was doing the same way that Bill Casey did. As Casey's deputy, at several different points, for example, when Casey's out of the office, when Casey's traveling, this kind of thing, that kind of thing, things had to be done in this framework of the Iran-Contra thing, and as Casey's deputy, those things suddenly came to Bob Gates. Now, here's a management question. You know, something you never heard of comes up to you like this, and it's pretty weird. Do you go find out about it or not? And in all these cases, Gates chose to distance himself from these activities. He either deliberately didn't seek knowledge of those activities, or when he found out something, he delayed informing other people who might have blown the whistle on what was going on, instead of, going ahead in a forthright fashion. There is culpability of omission, if not commission, in all of these activities.
Huh. How about during the time when Donald Rumsfeld was going to Iraq and shaking the hands of Saddam Hussein? Wasn't that under his when he was also deputy director, when Gates was also deputy director?
No, at the time that Rumsfeld went to Iraq and shook hands with Saddam, Gates was the intelligence director at the CIA, so he was in charge of monitoring and managing CIA analysis. Now, there's a different angle there, and that is, this is not directly connected with Iran-Contra, but in the early 1980s, the United States undertook this opening to Iraq, which is in fact exemplified by that Rumsfeld visit. And the Rumsfeld visit began a process of the United States sharing intelligence information with Iraq. And later on, went as far as U.S. naval protection and reflagging of tankers moving up and down the Persian Gulf, which was a policy that essentially favored Iraq. During the course of this, the United States on several occasions provided Iraq with intelligence information about its Iranian enemy. Now, as the intelligence manager at the CIA, it was up to Gates to provide that intelligence, to select what intelligence was going to be handed over. That's where he has some involvement with the early Iraq situation.
Didn't the U.S. also supply weapons to Iraq?
The U.S. supplied the precursors for various chemicals. It supplied some manufacturing processes. Oh. It helped facilitate Iraqi access to French and other weapons. The Iraqis depended primarily on France and Russia for its weapons, and with some additional sort of technical type stuff from the Germans and the British.
He also just quit the Iraq study group, right, this week. And what do you think his influence would have been on that study group that's going to be public, their report soon?
That's an interesting question as well. I think that Gates has favored a more moderate position vis-a-vis Iran than the Bush administration has taken. And I was expecting that his influence would encourage the study group to propose a kind of a grand diplomatic bargain, which would open relations with Iran and Syria as a mechanism for isolating insurgents inside of Iraq. I think without Gates, that it's very likely that the survey group is going to propose some kind of arrangement like that, if only because that's one of the few avenues that the Bush administration has not tried. The problem with it is that it's actually not responsive to the kind of violence that's going on in Iraq today. The Iraq war is beyond this idea of some insurgency that's supported by outside powers, and it's now focused on really a confessional kind of war, something more like the Lebanese Civil War of the 1970s and 80s.
So this report that's going to come up is, I heard on NPR this morning that somebody had characterized this as political cover for Bush. If he wants to do something different, then he can say the report said to do it.
Yes, I think that's correct, that it's being perceived as a possible political cover. The key is, does the report recommend U.S. withdrawal from Iraq or not? I'm not sure that the report is going to recommend such a withdrawal. I think that this kind of grand bargain that I'm referring to here is going to be viewed more in the context of a way of stabilizing Iraq so that the current level of forces there can succeed in implanting the Iraqi government, rather than reduce the violence in Iraq so that U.S. forces can withdraw.
Do you think Gates would on his own recommend earlier withdrawal?
I think that is a possibility. Gates is going to go into the Department of Defense, and his history at the CIA, he was director of it from 1991 through 93, early 93. His history at the CIA was very much one of deal-making. And the big deal to be made at the Department of Defense today is one between the civilian leadership and the American military, who've been very restive under Rumsfeld's leadership. Rumsfeld's policies and his activities other than Iraq have very much discomfited the U.S. military. So I think that Gates is going to go far in the other direction of redeveloping positive relations between the military and the civilians at the Pentagon. And then, to the degree that the military in the U.S. Is concerned about its own potential damage and losses from the Iraq war, and thus is favoring a withdrawal from Iraq, I think that Gates might be expected to look favorably on that kind of position and therefore recommend it.
How about all the criticism from within the military or the generals who have spoken out? How would he deal with that?
Well, I think that's a good sign of this. The generals were speaking out against Rumsfeld. They haven't taken a position on Gates, and
yeah.
I think that we can expect the generals to take a wait-and-see attitude with regard to Gates before making up their minds. Gates is obviously aware that this restiveness is there, so that's exactly what's going to move him in the direction of making compromises with the military.
How does this situation compare with the Vietnam War? I mean, you've written about the Vietnam War, about intelligence and military intelligence, etc. And how do you see the two wars? How would you compare what's happening today with what was happening in Vietnam?
There are many ways to compare Iraq with Vietnam, and yes, I have written on many aspects of the Vietnam War, not just the intelligence. I think we need to sort of narrow that focus a bit there. I mean, there are similarities with respect to decision-making. There are similarities with respect to the kinds of warfare that are going on. There are similarities with respect to U.S. forces and their ability to prosecute the wars. What kind of comparison are you interested in here?
How about the pullout,
the withdrawal.
Yeah,
okay.
Withdrawal. Or LBJ, was he adding troops at some point, and then he, or was he, I can't remember.
Yes, absolutely. The Vietnam War started with a major decision for intervention in the summer of 1965, and a large U.S. expeditionary force was put into South Vietnam, and the U.S. government continued to add to that force until the middle of 1968. It actually peaked in early 1969. And the progress of the war set up a situation after the Tet Offensive of 1968 when it became clear that additional force increases weren't going to yield success, while at the same time the public was so soured on the war that the only practical course was to begin a process of gradual withdrawal. And that's what happened in Vietnam from 1969 through 1973, punctuated by a U.S. government that wanted to pursue the war in a different way, but that's a different issue here. The difference between Vietnam and Iraq is that we intervened in Iraq with a given force on day one, that is, with the invasion, and we've maintained that force constantly within some range of boundaries. We've reinforced it a little bit at the times of the Iraqi elections and stuff like this, but essentially it's the same force or size of force that we had at the time that we invaded Iraq. And what's going on with the Bush administration right now is that they are resisting the kinds of appeals to withdraw that the Johnson administration was resisting in, say, 1967 and 1968 and early 1969. So they're really in that kind of a middle phase. They have not actually reached any kind of decision to conduct a phased withdrawal of U.S. forces, and indeed the Bush administration doesn't want to make a decision like that. And that's exactly why this Iraq strategy group thing is being cited as a potential political cover, because some people believe that with recommendations like theirs, Bush could withdraw forces while saying that it's not his fault, so to speak.
One big difference, of course, is there's no draft now. And you know, and during the Vietnam War, there was a draft, at least at the beginning, right? And,
yes, that's a difference, but that difference has dissipated, shall I say? That difference went in the direction of reducing the political impact of the war and therefore freeing the administration to prosecute the war. But as you see, the evolution of American politics has moved past that now, so it's no longer, that's not a factor anymore. Now we're at the situation where it is, in fact, a question of prosecute the war or withdraw.
Do you think the fact that National Guard's people are used this in this war, and they're saying that people have to go back for another tour, is that going to, that would impact a lot more people in the community, so that they would be much more aware of the war?
Absolutely. Not only that, but the use of the regular forces. One significant difference between this war and the Vietnam War is that during Vietnam, we deployed forces to Southeast Asia, and then we sent individual people over there to keep those forces active and involved. In the Iraq War, the U.S. procedure has been to send complete units of troops and then bring them home again. But the result of that is that we are bringing them home, sending them back, bringing them home, sending them back. There are units in the U.S. military already that have been to Iraq three times, and some individuals who've probably been there more times than that. And that's not only a factor with the National Guard, but it's also a factor with the regular military. Now, with the National Guard, there's a certain analogous quality to this kind of involvement on their part to the draft of the Vietnam War, because, in fact, that's generalizing the experience more for the American public. There are more people involved in the National Guard. They're coming right out of their communities. So that's reaching communities in a way that the draft used to do in the Vietnam War. But with the military and their repeated deployments, this has got to be one of the foundations for the discomfort of senior military leaders with the progress of the war in Iraq, because they see their forces as continually going back, becoming exhausted, losing the edge that they had, losing their equipment, and essentially becoming not effective forces. And that has got to preoccupy the U.S. military leaders.
The Students for Peace and Justice on campus just showed Sir No Sir, the documentary on GI resistance during the Vietnam War. Do you see that as happening in this war?
I think there is there is GI resistance that is already starting in the Iraq War. There is a group that has formed called Iraq Veterans Against the War, who are actively opposing the war. Mm-hmm. And there is a petition that is circulating right now among active duty military calling for a withdrawal from Iraq. And as I understand it, this has already garnered hundreds of signatures, this petition, and the organizers of it are hoping to bring the petition to the U.S. government early next year with 1,000 or more signatures. Now, this is not on the level of the GI opposition at the time of the Vietnam War, but on the other hand, what you're looking at is an early stage, and a stage before the U.S. government has, in fact, made a decision to make any withdrawals. So I would expect to see that if there is continuing resistance to making withdrawals from Iraq, that this kind of opposition will increase.
Also, there's at least one commission officer who is
yes, that's right, who's refused deployment and is going for court martial.
Right, but
Lieutenant Watada.
Right, and actually, I had his parents gave a talk in City of Orange. At Chapman University, which I aired on the show earlier, and he's now facing, I guess, this week they are going to go ahead with the military is going to go ahead with the court martial, and I think he faces 5 years in prison.
Unfortunate, but true. Yes, that's right.
How about this? So, how would Gates handle the? I guess the Democrats are going to start hearings, I suppose, on Iraq. At least that's the news. That they're likely to do that. How would he? I mean, since he wasn't in charge, do you think how he would fare under the hearings?
I think he has a natural defense, which you just cited, that he wasn't in charge. Gates will not have much of a problem with hearings on the previous situation with respect to Iraq, the Iraq pre-war intelligence issues, the issues of previous Iraq strategy. I think Gates' problem will arise only in the context of when the public, the officials, and the Congress begin to consider future strategy. And future strategy, of course, is a major piece of the equation. It's this whole question of do we withdraw or do we not withdraw, or do we prosecute the war to the fullest extent, or do we adopt some other course, like giving extra support to the Iraqi government but drawing down U.S. military forces. And that's where Gates will come into play. Now, I think personally that Gates holds pretty conservative views, and that's what makes him attractive to the Bush administration in the first place. So I would expect him probably to oppose a withdrawal if it was just up to him. But then you've got the factor of his relations with the military elite in the Pentagon. And that brings me back to that other point that I made.
That he's not that experienced.
Yeah. Not that he's not that experienced, but that he faces the necessity for compromise in order to keep a happy ship at the Department of Defense.
How about this court decision in Germany that named Rumsfeld and was it Cheney as war criminals or whatever? And there's a court that doesn't apply to the entire management team of the Pentagon. I mean, it wouldn't transfer to him, right? To
that's correct.
So he can still travel to Germany. But How would he, I mean, how do you think he would deal with Abu Ghraib? Is he going to shut it down totally? And this whole torture business with no habeas corpus. And I suppose, do you think the Democrats would try to change some of that policy on interrogating prisoners?
I think the interrogation policy is still up for grabs, yes. It's still controversial. The law that was passed by this session of Congress is going to be controversial, and it may not survive a court challenge, and that court challenge has already begun. So the issue is not going away, and it's going to be there for Gates to face. Now, Gates has some background for this as a result of his service in the CIA, since the CIA, you know, for many years was a champion of less physical, if that's the right term, mm-hmm. less physical methods of intelligence interrogation, and held the strong belief that torturing and those kinds of so-called alternate techniques did not yield good intelligence information. So if Gates is true to that CIA experience, I think you might see him doing good things with respect to Pentagon interrogation policy.
Do you think, though, that during the Vietnam War, that the incidents of throwing people off helicopters, was that just a South Vietnamese army military thing and not the CIA practice? They looked the other way, right? The CIA probably obviously knew about it.
Yes, I think the general problem with intelligence interrogation policy in the Vietnam War was that there was not a dedication to enforcing a specific policy. Rather, it was very much a sort of catch-as-catch-can kind of thing that depended on the specific relationships between a U.S. officer and the South Vietnamese that he was working with.
Mm-hmm.
Over the period of the war and over the different places that the war was fought and over the different kinds of situations that all of those people found themselves in, you know, there were many instances of all kinds of action, including Americans stopping the Vietnamese from doing things like that,
mm-hmm.
but also situations where Vietnamese prisoners were tortured and Americans did nothing about it. That problem transfers from Vietnam to Iraq. But what's different here in Iraq is that we are attempting to enforce a uniform policy for everyone across the board. And as you can see from our experience since Abu Ghraib was revealed, we've had not great success with that uniform policy in the beginning, because the policy was wrong-headed and in fact was leading to the torture of people. But as it has continued, also the problem continues because the different units of the U.S. military, special forces, for example, enforces the policy differently than the military police units, or the intelligence interrogation specialists enforce the policy different from special forces. So again, you have this lack of uniformity and continuity, even though we're trying and we're saying that we have a uniform policy.
Do you think with this, the creation of this new intelligence czar, so-called head of intelligence, is there more coordination between the military and the CIA, for instance?
In some respects, there is more coordination between the military and the CIA, yes. Whether that's to the advantage of the intelligence community or to the advantage of the Pentagon is another issue, though. And one of the problems with Rumsfeld has been that he has essentially been moving in the direction of centralizing intelligence within the Defense Department, so that more and more of the power of the intelligence community was focused there. And one of the very interesting things about the Gates appointment is going to be how Gates moves on that issue. Since, as a previous CIA director, Gates has some knowledge of these issues and some interest in them, and as Secretary of Defense, he's going to have direct control of 85% to 90% of the intelligence budget, and he's going to have these mechanisms and capabilities that Rumsfeld has built. On the other hand, as an intelligence person, Gates may have an interest in making sure that those capabilities are managed by the Director of National Intelligence. So this is a place where I think he's going to have different pressures on him, and he might go either way, and it's going to be interesting to see what he does.
Is the military use of the National Security Agency, for instance, in Iraq, mainly devoted to finding out where the insurgents are? Or how do you think that is being used this time?
I think that historically the National Security Agency has in fact been used primarily to look for the insurgents. I think in the most recent past, in the development of this whole ethnic cleansing thing that's going on over there, we're probably desperate to get some line on and some pre-warning of the kinds of activities that are involved in that. And National Security Agency would be a prime place to turn because, you know, you can intercept and monitor the radio communications of the Iraqi security forces who are, you know, a key to the involvement in this whole issue. And the question really is, to what degree can the NSA be effective doing that?
And how about the domestic implications in terms of domestic surveillance? Do you see, you know, with the Patriot Act, with all these other legal changes, that they can spy on people making phone calls abroad, I suppose. What do you see? How do you see Gates will handle that?
I think Gates is going to follow the Bush line on the subject of wireless intercepts and the National Security Agency domestic surveillance program. There is one other area, though, where he might run a different course than Rumsfeld, and that is in this whole question of military surveillance of American citizens. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there have been several different Pentagon units that have become more and more involved in following the activities of normal Americans. For example, the Air Force's Talon Gold program. And Gates might very well shut down some of that activity.
What is the Talon Gold program?
This started off as an effort to look at the activities of people that surrounded U.S. air bases and identify things that might be a threat to the security of the airbase or the base. And it evolved progressively from that into tracking ordinary anti-war sentiment and stuff like that, and then making people who were objecting to the U.S. in Iraq or objecting to U.S. military activities, casting them somehow as active and real security threats to the United States, and their databases and files, just like the whole surveillance and of the anti-war movement during Vietnam War days. It's a sort of smaller version of that.
Yeah, for sure. The I did a piece once for the OC Weekly here out here in Orange County, and this was when the El Toro Naval Base was closing. And I did a FOIA request for files on UCI, actually, and UCI stuff. And they asked me, FBI didn't have it, and I referred me to Naval Intelligence. And I got this all these documents on the first UCI class in 60-something. And they were surveilling the protests at outside the El Toro base. Naval Intelligence had transcripts of all the speeches.
This from the 1960s?
Yeah, 60s, yeah. Of the SDS chapter that started at Irvine, even. And the TA and the student, they had their information on it and pictures. They took down license plates of every vehicle that was parked in the Irvine train station, and because that was near the Autorio base, I guess. So anyway, there was a whole file on them and on what they said, actually. They took down transcripts, yeah, of all the speeches. And I tracked down the SDS leader at the time, and she didn't even remember all that. So that was naval intelligence that released the files.
And now we have an analog to that in the Iraq War situation. So these things are dangerous to American civil liberties and civil rights, and the intelligence agencies have some background in, because of being burned as a result of that Vietnam experience, they were very heavily criticized and attacked for what took place during Vietnam. That experience may lead Gates to shut down some of these new Pentagon activities.
So he doesn't want any more controversy, obviously.
I can't say whether he does or whether he doesn't, but I can see this as a reason for him not doing it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. How about his experience in the CIA as an analyst? Do you think he was doctoring? That was one issue, I guess, during his confirmation hearings for CIA director. Was he slanting intelligence to favor political points of view?
Yes, those were the charges against Gates at the time of his nomination for director of CIA. And they were pretty heavily sustained by a whole variety of CIA analysts who came up and gave testimony about the kinds of things that Gates had done. And essentially those charges added up to the man knowing what his bosses wanted and serving them the kind of stuff that they wanted to hear, making sure that they got the kind of stuff that they wanted to hear. So I think this is an index of Robert Gates's ambition. That ambition, I'm sure, has not changed. And the way that it will play out at the Department of Defense isn't going to be so much as a matter of intelligence analysis. Now it's going to be more in terms of policy programming for military programs, including the Iraq War, but also other potential U.S. foreign involvement, such as with North Korea and Iran. So I have some misgivings about that. Mm-hmm. And about the way that's going to play out. We know that Gates has publicly taken a position about Iran as opposed to Iraq, and that is one of being in favor of having more contact with the Iranians. So that's good from that standpoint. And there will be a question as to whether his desire to serve his president, that is George W. Bush, will be greater than these opinions he has held in the past, or whether he will speak and hold the opinions that he has had in the past into the future.
He has good terms. He's on good terms with Democrats before, right?
Yes, he has had good relations with Democrats before. During those nomination hearings that you were just mentioning,
yeah,
he faced all of this opposition from CIA analysts, and he was saved, in fact, by his good relationships with some of the Democratic leaders on the Senate Intelligence Committee. So he does have the ability to have good relations with across political lines.
How about John Conyers? How would he deal with if he's, I mean, he's being elevated to committee chair, right?
Well, I can't comment on the specific relationships between Gates and individual people. I'm not aware of that level of detail.
Oh, yeah.
But I expect that the Gates nomination will be dealt with before the Congress changes hands in January.
Oh.
I expect these hearings will probably take place before then.
Wow, it'll be rushed. Yeah.
Yes.
How about this whole thing of, I know when he was in the CIA, there was a prohibition against assassination, but it doesn't seem to be applying now, right? I mean, they can go use drones and kill people.
There was a prohibition against assassination. It's still on the books. It's on the it's in the executive order that governs intelligence activities. But my understanding is that the so-called presidential finding that President Bush signed at the beginning of, right after 9/11, that that finding permitted an exception to this rule. So all of this activity is going on as an exception to the rule that's on the books.
Is the surveillance, the domestic surveillance, also considered an exception to the Privacy Act prohibition on collecting information on Americans and permanent residents?
I don't think so. I'm not aware of any legal authorization for this activity. I believe it's illegal.
Yeah. So how do you sum up his nomination? Do you feel that he's going to sail through the nomination process?
I think Gates will have good chances for confirmation in the U.S. Senate. I think that the problems that he had at the CIA are long ago in the past. There will be a reference to, if not some discussion of, his Iran-Contra role, but that again, that will be excused as something that was long into the past. And most of the interest is going to be on Gates's policy predilections with respect to North Korea, China, Iraq, and Iran. And perhaps Gates's opinions of the North Atlantic Alliance as well.
Is the fact that he was an analyst rather than a covert operative, is that better for you? I mean, in do you think you see that as less threatening or not? I mean, some people argue that the analysis side supports the covert action side, and so I mean, is there really a difference between his experience as an analyst before rather than an operative?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, definitely, CIA analysis does support covert activity. On the other hand, some arguments run that covert activity involving operations the way it does leads to particular kinds of activities that are more anti-democratic or more have more flap potential. That's a word they like to use over at the CIA. They have more flap potential than analysis. And that analysis has tended to be more conservative politically and more in tune with democratic values. Now, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but I will say this, and that is that it's of personal advantage to Robert Gates, having come up as an analyst within the CIA, in today's political context, because simply by not being involved in all kinds of nefarious CIA misdeeds, he has not accumulated that baggage. So he's going to arrive at this nomination hearing without a whole bunch of controversial involvements in particular CIA covert action programs other than Iran-Contra. And, you know, someone else who had a background like that could have been damaged by it.
Are you worried, though, that intelligence people or former CIA people or other intelligence, industry people are, or intelligence background people are now heading different departments in the U.S., in the government, or is that not a thing for concern?
Well, this has played both ways, really. You've got a lot of military people who are headed over to the intelligence area. For example, there's an Air Force general in charge of the CIA, and there's another general who's the Deputy Director of National Intelligence. And the Director of National Intelligence is a diplomat, not a spy at all. Now you've got a spy going to take over the military. So it's a kind of a confusing situation. It doesn't really reveal much, you know.
And Bush
perhaps the military will take over the intelligence side, and the intelligence side will take over the military side. I mean, that's kind of strange.
And Bush's father was, CIA.
Bush's father had been president CIA for a year. That's right.
But in terms of recruitment, do you think you said earlier that the military is now recruiting more people, or is now doing more intelligence, more spying, or something? And are they? What kind of people would they be recruiting as opposed to what the CIA would be recruiting, or is it the same? In terms of like,
I would say that a lot is the same, but some is different. The CIA, for its field officers, for its case officers, has sought a certain kind of a person who could fit in foreign societies and conduct so-called non-official cover type operations. And the military traditionally has looked for the gung-ho special action type, the Green Beret, who's going to be on Delta Force or whatever. But the military is moving more toward the CIA style of recruitment because a lot of the they call them knuckle draggers in the business. A lot of the obvious knuckle draggers are not much good as spies because they are, in fact, obviously military people. So it's hard for them to keep cover. So the military is moving more essentially to poach, if you like, on traditional CIA recruiting grounds. And that also is a problem, and it's going to be a growing problem because the military has much greater resources than the intelligence agency does.
We often get the CIA people on this campus to recruit, and the military just opened a recruiting station across the street, which seems kind of empty. Nobody seems to go in. It's opposite UC Irvine. I was going to ask you about the... Do you think that they are focusing a particular... language skills of ethnic groups?
Both, absolutely. Language skills and ethnic groups are two of the key problems that face the U.S. intelligence community today, both the military and the CIA.
Mostly Middle Eastern or
across the board.
Yeah, across the board.
Yes, across the board, absolutely.
There's
a real problem because Americans are not multilingual in large part. And that has historically been a problem. It was a problem even before there was a terror war. But in this kind of a conflict situation, it's even more a problem. I mean, today in Iraq, we've got 140,000 troops.
Yeah.
And, probably not more than a couple of hundred fluid translators for them in our own ranks. And we can hire any number of freelance-type private government, private organization-type people, but look at the private organization problems that have followed from doing a lot of that.
One of my students was trying to get up in the company that gets military funding, and so some kind of military intelligence person called me up and wanted to do an interview with me about the student. And the first thing she asked was, does he smoke pot? But pot isn't a barrier, right? I mean, and I think as long as you explain it, I mean, even presidents have smoked pot, but...
I would have thought that they were beyond that now.
Yeah.
Well, that's conditions for holding a security clearance... have long been controversial, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And on the books, there are rules like those. There was a time, probably in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when if in an interview you discovered the person had not smoked pot, you would have thought that was unusual. and under those conditions, people stopped using this criteria for a security clearance or not, because, in fact, you couldn't hire anybody who hadn't had that experience. I don't think that's true anymore, so maybe now they're enforcing that regulation again.
Or maybe it's okay to say you did it, and because you're not lying.
Right, that's possible too.
Yeah, yeah. So in general, do you see the bureaucracy growing under Gates when he gets confirmed as Defense Secretary?
Well, I think that the Pentagon bureaucracy has grown over the years and fairly constantly. I don't expect that it will grow any faster under Gates than it has been already. And I do think that the pressures of the costs of conducting warfare and the desires of fielding new weapons is going to force the Pentagon into some kind of a budget crunch, in particular because the need for the warfare mechanisms is going to really require them to have more troops. I mean, the U.S. military is just stretched too far, so stretched too tightly. There's going to be some pressure on reducing costs somewhere, and perhaps some of that will come out of the bureaucracy. I would like to see that happen. I think there are too many managers, too many chiefs, and not enough Indians.
Yeah. How about the draft? Do you think there's a chance they'll reinstate the draft since they're running out of people?
That's a good question. I don't think there's any current chance that they will reinstate the draft. I do think you're right that problem is waiting in the wings, and at some point, if they can't meet the recruitment goals, they'll be forced to do or go for it. After not meeting the enlistment goals for 2004, they actually did meet them for 2005. So they're looking good at the moment, and they're probably a little bit relieved about that. But there's no telling what it's going to look like a year from now.
And if they get involved in another war, that'll be...
Also, in addition.
Right.
That's right.
But do you think they're really too overstretched right now to fight another war? I mean, the principle was that they could fight several wars at a time before, right? That was a conventional wisdom.
Yes, we've gotten away from that principle. That's correct. I do not believe we have the capability to fight another war at this time.
Yeah, yeah. They're still going to schools to recruit, right? I mean, there's lots of efforts at recruit. Now they have the right legally to go call your... there was a student at this showing of the Sir No Sir film, and she's a foreign student, and she said she got a call from a recruiter on her cell phone. I mean, I don't know how they got that.
Good question. Yes, they have the legal right to do that. That's true.
Yeah, that's incredible. For a foreign student, they're recruiting and they're promising citizenship after you enter the military.
Uh-huh.
To her.
That's another inducement to sign up.
Yeah, maybe, or at least maybe. That was also in the professor who was leading the discussion was saying that they did that. Did they do that somewhat after the Vietnam War, maybe? You know, that once you came in, there were some people that were given citizenship, early, kind of expedited citizenship.
Uh-huh.
Because you don't have to be a U.S. citizen to fight for the U.S.
That's correct.
So, well, thank you very much,
John
Prados.
Well, my pleasure.
Yeah, and it was a really revealing interview. Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was John Prados, who is the author of a book called Safe for Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA. But he has also been a prolific writer on national security issues. And as he said, on Vietnam War, including a book on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so this is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. First, an update. As we already mentioned, this week saw the going ahead of the court-martial of Erin Watada, who is the first commissioned officer to resist the deployment, to refuse deployment to Iraq. He sits in Fort Lewis now at a desk job, facing at least 5 years in prison. So the court-martial is expected to start early next year. Also in today's new university here at UCI, the student paper. The headline is 15 arrested at Ayn Rand club event. And these are LaRouche people who have been quite prolific on campus last few weeks, giving out magazines that attack people like Chip Berlay, who was on our show last week. And anyway, the police, as we have reported in earlier show, have been getting more active in events. And the First Amendment allows free speech on campus, but the campus administration seems to be narrowing the focus and the venues where free speech is allowed. And these were 15 LaRouche youth, so-called, people who were at that event of Ayn Rand, and where they were chanting and singing, and they were hauled away. So up to 15 were taken away. Pictures on the picture on the front page of the new university, and you can find this online, I think, eventually at newu.uci.edu. On our earlier show, we talked to Student Worker Alliance activists, where one of the students was also arrested a few weeks ago at a political protest at the flagpole at UC Irvine. And we'll keep you updated on the case faced by that Vietnamese-American activist who was taken away in a police car. And she faces a $2,000 fine and 6 months in jail for apparently taking the advice of the police officer who told her to touch him. And when she touched him, she was charged with battery on a police officer. So that seems kind of upping the ante with the UCI Police Department. So it's not a good week for civil liberties. We're going to end with a little song on this week, what's happening this week, as we usually do.